Welcome to GradCast, the official radio show and podcast of the Society of Graduate Students at Western University. I'm your host, Liam Clifford.
And I'm your co-host, Mark Ambrosio.
And today we have another interview for you. This comes by the way of John Kausch, who is a PhD in information science with FIMS. John, very welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Mark, it's lovely to see you again. I look forward to another interview. I do not know John personally, but I understand that we all sort of know each other through different friends, so I'm looking forward to the conversation irrespective.
I am. Yeah, I am as well. And John is a very prominent person on campus, so I've been very much looking forward to this interview.
Absolutely. So John, we'll start you off with a softball question. I love asking people what initially brought them to Western.
Well, I was completing a master's degree in information science in England, and I was looking for a place to do a PhD. And I found the work of Dr. Kamran Sadiq online and reached out to him about supervising a dissertation. And he was really, of all the places I was looking at, he was actually the best fit. So it was really from research interests and finding a member of faculty who really aligned well with my research that I came out here to Western.
Yeah.
The rest was history.
Absolutely. It's such an important thing to see the alignment of both research, the particular supervisor, and what you want to study for your dissertation. So why don't we jump right into it? We have obviously discussed ahead of time a little bit about what you study, but why don't you refresh our listeners' memory?
Well, I think not many people are familiar with information science as a discipline. It comes from the intersection of library science and computer science and has to do with formal methods of organizing information, either in documents or in the digital world. It's especially emerged since libraries have been transitioning to being multimedia repositories for information, as theorists and practitioners needed more abstract ways to understand information and how it functioned. I work in visualizing knowledge organization systems, particularly a kind of knowledge organization system, which is like a library cataloging system, called an ontology. And an ontology is a special kind of knowledge organization system that uses logic, that makes use of philosophy to describe how objects should be organized. They're often used in the life sciences. The gene ontology and the human phenotype ontology are a couple of the most famous ontologies that allow you to organize data for science. So my research is in visualizing these ontologies to allow people to make associations between data, building visualizations and visual systems.
Excellent. I admittedly had to dig out my political science notes to familiarize myself with what an ontology is again, and its relationship to epistemology. Now, we'll obviously talk about that, but that sounds remarkable. I think the sorting of data is such an important thing in this day and age that we'll continue to unpack as the conversation progresses.
Yeah, I think it's very important, especially when you see all the misinformation in the world. Definitely.
Yeah, I think that's a very good overview that you gave, John, because people misunderstand A, what library science is, and B, they may underestimate the relationship between library and information science. So here at Western, we have the Faculty of Information and Media Studies, which includes media studies, health information studies, and library and information science. So there's a combination of disciplines there overlapping. There's some interdisciplinary work and some work that's more fits neatly into one silo more so than the other two. But library and information sciences itself, the intersection of library science and information science. And I like how you describe knowledge organization, because in a way, although information science and library science have different backgrounds, library science can sometimes be seen as professional training for librarianship, and information science, as you say, has a relationship with computer science. They both have knowledge organization in common, and that's where they overlap. And I think sometimes people may see, well, why? What is the purpose of studying in an area like library and information science? Like, surely, you know, cataloging has all been done before. What's the point? But the moment you scratch the surface, you realize, well, no, it's not all been done before. Mm-hmm. There's a lot still happening. Mm-hmm. And can you perhaps give us a bird's eye view as to what does your research add to the body of research that has come before?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, I think, you know, to your point, lots of computer scientists are doing information science work without realizing that they are doing it, because it becomes necessary when you're building many computer systems today, especially in artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. And because library and information science has been traditionally devalued as a field, It's been seen as a practitioner field, less intellectual, and the theory isn't as I shouldn't say that it is not as developed, because we have very well-developed theories that have been created, but there's a perception that the theory is not as well-developed.
We know that we have. Yes.
So there has been a tendency for computer scientists to reinvent knowledge organization systems. At least this is what I see. I'm speaking colloquially.
Yes.
But when you look at the sorts of solutions that they come up with, people are not aware that you have hundreds of years of work in knowledge organization that has been done, and that information science grew organically. It really started with Paul Otley and the Mundaneum in Belgium, where he had this vision of organizing all of the documents in the world that became document studies, which later became information science, in an incredibly complex microfilm system that really was a direct predecessor to the internet. The people, Sir Tim Berners-Lee was very aware of Otley when the World Wide Web was being made. Sorry, I should make that distinction. Not the internet, which comes from ARPANET, but the web, which comes from Sir Tim Berners-Lee.
That's a good distinction.
But my work is making a contribution in the visualization of ontologies and classification systems which already exist. I am not as enthusiastic about creating new classification systems, because we have a proliferation of standards, which happen in many international standards organizations, that never lead to the integration and unity which people, their creators, claim that they will. But I am interested in taking existing ontologies and creating translations between those ontologies. And that is the real focus of my work, is creating a formal model for knowledge translation. And that has implications, especially for the health sciences. But I want to extend models of knowledge translation from beyond the health sciences to make it a part of knowledge organization generally, and to make it a methodology that can be used as well in addition to domain analysis, which is the chief method, which since Birger Hjørland has been used in knowledge organization to organize knowledge in a knowledge organization system. So that's my main interest as a researcher, is saying you have these different metaphysical worlds that knowledge communities create, and that necessitates different knowledge organization systems. How do you translate between these different worlds? Mm-hmm. And how can you formally assess the value of a translation outside of just saying that something is statistically correlated to something else? How can you formally assess the value of a translation? Those are the questions I'm really interested in.
Very good.
That's really interesting. I'm always so curious as to see how different modes of information are classified, right? Because that changes our perception about how that information is utilized within a given society or a given context. For context, to continue that, how would you define ontology?
We really should have done that at the beginning, probably. And so ontology comes from philosophy, and it means the study of being. So an information ontology makes use of concepts from philosophy and tools from philosophy to build a very rigorous classification system that's usually less dependent on language. So the first ontologies, emerged with like Thales of Miletus and these other pre-Socratic philosophers who were speculating on what is the essential substance of the world. And since then, you have 2,000 years of history of ontology as well, that you can look in the history of philosophy, how Aristotle and late Platonist philosophers talked about dividing things into categories and into species and genera, and this would influence the Linnaean classification system in biology that we all learn in school. So the idea of an ontology is that it is a set of assumptions about the world that allow you to organize the world hierarchically. It's about the study of what is, the study of being, because ontos in Greek means being.
Yeah, I'm struck by how developed the field is. Since antiquity should not be understated, because it's a remarkable development of philosophy throughout thousands of years of human history. What brought you to study something like this?
So I started in linguistics. I had very pure research questions about language. I was very interested in what is meaning. How do words have meanings? How can you formally model the meanings of utterances in linguistics? And so I was never as interested in what in linguistics is called syntax or grammar as I was in semantics. Noam Chomsky created this idea of universal grammar, which is that there are these syntactic structures in the human mind that we absorb through the language faculty as children. And I was never as interested in syntax as I was in semantics, because I wanted to understand how we could verify that a sentence is truly compositional, that it really refers to what it it says that it means. And this takes you into logic and into philosophy of language and into some of these questions. And so but I was very frustrated with formal logic to describe language. I was frustrated with the notations that we had to describe language with formal logic. And so I came to information science really through wanting to, because you write propositions, logical propositions, in a dedicated set of symbols that are supposed to describe what a sentence means behind the grammar or the words in a sentence. And that's supposed to be a scientific description. And then you have usually some binding algorithm that will bind the words in the sentence to the predicate calculus that will then bind it to some meanings. And the meanings always still rely on ground truth. They always beg the question for me. I wanted to understand the lexicon. So I was working on a project in Berkeley called Panlex, where they were trying to build a dictionary of every word in every language.
Wow.
And so it's a huge project. It was very, very ambitious. And I think they had about 1 billion translations when it finally settled down, in 2,000 of the world's 6,000 languages. So a massive resource. And that was where I started. Even though the project was funded by the Long Now Foundation, or it was under the aegis of the Long Now Foundation, so they were trying to produce resources to preserve language for the next 10,000 years. And one of the things that Long Now does is they produce these little Rosetta disks where they micro-etch the Universal Declaration for Human Rights in as many languages as possible, and then they scatter them all across the world. They put some of them in space. They put some of them, like they put one of them on the Rosetta Common. Anyway, so the database was ostensibly supposed to do that, but the creators were scientifically more interested in what are the universal concepts that are shared across all of these languages. And so once you start doing that work, you start looking at graph databases of terms. I was actually entering the world of ontology without even knowing it. You start asking the same scientific and philosophical questions once you look at that. So it was a very organic growth process out of linguistics that led me here.
So people may wonder about the connection between contemporary information science and ancient philosophy, but it becomes very evident because this idea of meaning and classification, going back to Aristotle, he had a very unique system of knowledge. To know something is to like divide into its component parts, and to divide it is to compare it, and to compare it is to classify it. So a lot of, I know I'm speaking with broad brushstrokes here, but you know, a lot of what Aristotle was doing was classification. And I feel like you can see that as being the precedent for a lot of what we're doing in information science is, you know, classification and trying to understand. And I feel that Aristotle would be tremendously impressed with when you're talking about that, the idea of a universal dictionary, trying to encompass all the possible meanings and variants. I wanted to back up a little bit, though, about the idea about knowledge translation. I'm wondering, my question is, are we looking at translation from one professional community, let's say from computer scientists to, let's say, health practitioners, like from one professional community to another? Or to what extent does knowledge translation also involve academic dissemination of, like, the dissemination of academic research? So let's say taking academic research that's happening in the university, you have PhD theses, which very few people read, but taking that research and then translating it or sharing it to the public. I think, for example, John Tyndale, not the reformer Tyndale, but Tyndale, T-Y-N-D-A-L-L, from the 19th century, who, while a scientist in his own right, spent most of his career translating scientific research to be understood. So like when we talk about knowledge translation, are we talking about between professional communities or between professional communities and the public?
So ideally, I would like to create a model and a method for knowledge translation that could include both activities. When you look at knowledge translation as it's practiced today in Canada, because that's a very specific Canadian term that I'm using that refers to a specific knowledge to action science and policies within a healthcare context. You have something that does go between researchers and clinicians, researchers in the general public, researchers and policymakers, and of course between researchers and researchers themselves. Mm-hmm. But that's a very specific ecosystem where there are very real financial constraints and constraints in terms of patient care that incentivize that pipeline, the knowledge to action pipeline. And it's called knowledge transfer in the UK. And in the USA, I think translational medicine is maybe a little bit broader than what we call knowledge translation here in Canada, but it's, they're similar. These are all adjacent terms and adjacent disciplines. What I'm doing is trying to look at that as an application and apply it as well within knowledge organization generally. Mm-hmm. And when you talk about domain analysis, which is already an interdisciplinary methodology for working within the social epistemic world of a knowledge community and building a classification system, that's already an interdisciplinary method. I want to take things from knowledge translation and apply it so you can translate between any domains. Domains can be disciplines. They can be communities of scholars, but they can also be communities of practice. They can be folk communities. Domain is a very broad term that doesn't necessarily mean it's happening within the academy. So I hope to produce a model, and ultimately, I don't know how far this stream will go in my work, but ultimately I would like to produce a method that could be replicable in order to perform knowledge translational actions.
What sort of strategies, John, do they then use to translate this knowledge? I know that's the $6 million question we're talking about here, but are there, in your research, is there anything that you've seen sort of repeat itself in terms of either the larger strategy or certain tactics that institutions, or just to use the terminology, domains, are using to translate this knowledge?
Well, in implementation science and healthcare, they have, it's a very vast topic, actually, in a very vast array of practices that are used to validate whether a community of practice has actually implemented new knowledge, to validate whether that knowledge remains after the knowledge translation process in a couple of years. There are many different techniques that are used, particularly for clinicians, to ensure that they are taking in the next generation of research information. But I think the whole field has always, or as I understand the field, because this is a field that I'm just now entering, but as I understand the field has always struggled to consistently be able to define knowledge translation tasks, because you have different constraints every time you actually translate knowledge to a community of practice. But the field of implementation science has grown up to deal with these issues, and there are lots of people who work on it here at Western, actually, who are doing really great work in it.
Is part of the problem then of knowledge translation the inability to agree on what knowledge translates? Let me try that again, on what knowledge translation looks like, or the inability to agree on particular strategies?
So both. One of the problems with knowledge translation is that it's a polysemous term. Okay. And then also there are many different terms that refer to the same thing. So you have many different models and many different terms on a theoretical level, and they are applied differently in different countries. So there are many, and there are also many different people doing this who aren't necessarily all aware of each other. That's one problem. But then also in terms of the knowledge to action framework, you have some people are using it to refer to dissemination. Some people are using it to refer to putting research into practice. Mm-hmm. Right. Those are two very different things. And then how you assess them are very different. And then implementation science is now like looking at other things about like sustainability of knowledge translation, like I was just talking about.
Of course.
So all of these can be concerns, and people will use the same term in different ways. Mm-hmm. And then the granting agencies are changing the terms every few years as well. So now I think knowledge mobilization is preferred to knowledge translation.
I read an interesting article a couple of years ago on the information practices in a healthcare setting. Because you distinguish between academic dissemination, like in a more scholarly sense, and knowledge translation and knowledge organization, and then you talked about in a more professional sense, especially in healthcare. And it was an interesting article because talking about, for example, the dynamics between physicians and nurses. And nurses have their own bodies of knowledge, which were not necessarily footnoted, but just things procured through years of experience, which was perfectly valid. And then physicians might become walking in, and the physician might be more better educated, scare quotes, but then the nurse, but the physician, you know, he or she had the book knowledge, the nurse, he or she had the practical knowledge, but there seemed to be an inherent inability to communicate. In at least some instances. And speaking of abilities to communicate, you've spoken about the different, you know, knowledge mobilization and different terminologies between, like, in the academy, we have issues of translate, you know, we can be doing research in the English speaking world that people in the French speaking world may be entirely unaware of, and in the German speaking world may be entirely unaware of. But you mentioned that there are different terminologies between Canada, the United States, the UK. So I found that very interesting, because I wonder to what extent half, or maybe not half, but a large portion of your research involves overcoming those challenges.
Yeah, well, I think not only does a large portion of my research involve overcoming those challenges, that's almost explicitly the kind of method that I want us to take more seriously, in that we view making mappings between things as sort of a given when it's inherently fraught with the potential for ambiguity. Mm-hmm. And it's almost an impossible task, creating a translation. Everyone knows this. So even with it, like intralinguistically or interlinguistically,
yes,
it's very, very challenging because words are polysemous. But I think what you were talking about actually speaks to two other adjacent fields whose literatures I've also been looking at for models and for theories. One is knowledge management, mm-hmm. which is adjacent to information science, which I think people who work in knowledge translation are not always as aware of. Where you have different forms of tacit and explicit knowledge mm-hmm. in an organization, and a lot of knowledge management is about making sure that different groups can communicate effectively and that knowledge can be properly brokered. And then you also have translation studies, which offer formal models for how to understand linguistic translation and how to understand the act and the task of the translator. So I guess what I would say in answer to your question is that I am absolutely conscious of those challenges. Mm-hmm. But that I'm also explicitly trying to define them as I'm practicing them in a formal sense. And what I mean by formal is that I also am still interested in that original question of joining ontologies together. So I would really like a way to put in a formal language a metric that's as mathematically definable as possible, that you could assess how good a mapping is between two sets of terms, or the value of a mapping.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. I'm just reviewing my notes here and trying to incorporate what we've been sort of speaking about. I've noted your use of the word communication several times. And I want to ask you, how important is communication to the field of ontology?
That's a really good question. Because ontologies usually are not thought of as artifacts, or they weren't classically thought of as artifacts mm-hmm. that people are supposed to read. They're thought of as artifacts for machines okay. that will categorize information. The machine will inference over the data, and the axioms in the ontology will allow you to automatically infer classes. Like, you'll say that an apple is a subclass of fruit, and if you have in your data set an instance of an apple, the ontology will infer that it must be a fruit. That's a very simple inference that an ontology will do. But increasingly, we're seeing that because the reasoning in an ontology is explicit, it's very different from the kind of reasoning that we have in a machine learning system. A machine learning system will say something. A machine learning system will say, a bazooka is a flamingo, and you don't really have any way of assessing it. Right. Obviously, a well-trained model will say something that sounds coherent, but you don't have a way. There's no way of assessing the internal logic there, and there may not be any internal logic there. And so the advantage of an ontology is that it also allows you to communicate a body of scientific knowledge in a highly codified and precise form that can be readable by machines, but also a human being can open it up, look at it, and see, oh, I see apple is a subclass of fruit, and there's a reason for that, and someone wrote a note. So it has high fidelity, whereas a lot of the machine learning models we're producing right now do not necessarily have that.
Of course. I have to know for our listeners, did you get the flamingo reference from the shirt I'm wearing?
Gosh, I must have, on like some subconscious level. I don't know. I was reaching for
That's
a word.
Wow. Speaking
of communication, there we go. There's it in the flesh. Part of my next question is a segue to what Mark is saying about how we marry these things in different languages using different terms. So, sort of related to the question of communication, how essential is it in your mind that different, I guess for lack of a better term, ontologists are speaking with one another about transcribing these ideas and either seeking some sort of standardization, or, you know, is it worth noting the uniqueness in the field as well and the vibrancy that brings?
So, in information ontology today, there are dedicated standards defined by the semantic web. And that was part of Sir Tim Berners-Lee's vision for what was supposed to come after Web 2.0. We were supposed to have this third web of linked data that was going to transform everything. And instead, that hasn't materialized because the standards are very, very complex and speaking of communication, we have trouble actually communicating these complex information science standards in a way people can understand. But there are people who are trying new things. I've become interested in the community surrounding David Spivak, which uses category theory, a branch of mathematics that's an alternative foundation of alternative logical foundation for mathematics that bridges algebraic geometry and topology and allows you to make mappings between all these different fields. And people are also ostensibly writing ontologies with it in the Topos Institute. And so I have become interested in other communities who are doing the same thing, but like with some of the other communities I've been talking about, they're not necessarily aware of the standards in the semantic web community, which do exist or vetted. If you want to write an industry standard ontology, you write it in RDF, you use OWL, you edit it in Protégé, and you upload it to the linked open data cloud. So there are standards for that. They do exist, just not everyone knows about them.
I appreciate the clarification on that. Thank you.
So I have a two-part question. You mentioned earlier, John, that you did your Master's of Information in England. So maybe can you tell us a little bit about your academic journey? Where did you do your undergraduate? And then we'll ask you my follow-up question.
So I did my undergraduate at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland, and I spent 4 years studying linguistics because the Scottish system has you declare at the beginning, and you spend 4 years just doing one thing. So I did linguistics for 4 years there, and then I spent a few years working, and I did a variety of things, and then I went back to school in London, England, at City University of London for information science.
Brilliant.
And then I came right out here after that, from London to London, as I often remind everyone.
Yes. Never too far away, eh?
We're very glad to have you here at Western. Now, speaking of Western, and now we've spoken a lot about information science and your specialty, but I wonder if you could just back it a little bit and we could tell us a little bit about John. What do you do at Western here outside your academic studies?
I am the communications chair for PSAC, and we've been doing a lot of labor organizing recently, as many people here will know. I'm at the Rotman Institute of Philosophy for Engaging Science, although I suppose that still falls under academic studies.
Well, it's still interesting, yeah.
I've had a reading group there on exactly what we're talking about, knowledge translation and ontologies. That's been very, very fun. Other than that, I do like to write. I've written a novel about ancient Egypt. I like writing literature. That's about the only other noteworthy thing that I practice other than living and breathing ontology, because that's, PhD life.
Hey, listen, it's well worth promoting. My question, John, is as we start to wrap up this interview, is that I'm particularly fascinated by this. I enjoy the philosophical side of it, but I'm wondering how these ideas would be communicated to someone in the sciences who might not be aware of how amorphous a subject like this can be, how perhaps this might be a little less tangible, in the sense that there might be classification systems within a library that you can physically see, but what we're dealing here is a little more fluid and a little more theoretical. How would you transcribe those ideas, or how would you disseminate those ideas to someone in the sciences who's not as familiar with the theoretical background?
Well, it would depend on the science. I think even for physics, you still do need classification systems, although they're definitely more abstract. But if I were working in the chemical or the biological sciences, what I would say is that you have standardization already in your science, whether that's classifications for genes or for species, or for chemical elements. And it's necessary to be able to bridge those classifications so that you can understand how interdisciplines work, not just in fields like chemical physics or microbiology, but for any field, even fields that are ostensibly pure, that are just studying one subject. So it's about making connections between different standardized data sets and making sure that those connections are useful and true.
And I think it speaks to the presence of classification systems within academia and the constructive elements of that, and how sometimes that might also be limiting for particular subjects. So I appreciate that insight.
I really appreciate you joining us today, John. It's been a real pleasure, and it's been a really fascinating conversation. I feel like we could go easily for another half hour. If anyone wanted to learn more about your research, where online could you point them to?
So I have a portfolio on Observable, and you can follow me on Twitter as @Kausch. KAUSCH.
Perfect. Thank you very much. This has been GradCast, the official radio show and podcast of the Society of Graduate Students at Western University. I've been one of your hosts, Mark Ambrosio, and my co-host was Liam Clifford. We've been speaking with John Kausch, and this episode was produced by Susie Lee and Maria Khan. If you'd like to be involved with the show or get in contact with us, email us at gradcast@sogs.ca. You can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter at Gradcast Radio, and we're now on TikTok. To listen to us, we are on Radio Western 94.9 FM. You can find all our episodes wherever you find our podcasts. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the rest of your day.